Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, an associate professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. Today, we'll be talking to Matthew Jackson about his book, The Human Network, How Your Social Position Determines Your Power, Beliefs, and Behaviors. Network theory is a vibrant area of research across the social sciences and is crucial for anyone to understand who wants to understand social media, political echo chambers, pandemics, inequality, financial crises, and a lot more of important issues. Matt's one of the world's most influential academic researchers in this area, is the author of the authoritative textbook on network theory and economics, and numerous pathbreaking research articles. This book that we'll be discussing today distills all this work down to the level that any smart person can follow, so I highly recommend it. So with that, Matt, first, why don't you first tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Peter. It's great to be here. I'm an economist by training, but I think a person who's generally interested in human behaviors. And so over the years, I've gravitated towards studying social interactions pretty widely. And I use whatever tools are necessary to better understand how people behave and why they behave that way.
Okay. And you're a professor at Stanford?
Yes, I'm a professor at Stanford University. I'm also in the external faculty at Santa Fe Institute and interact with a lot of people through that.
Okay, great. Yeah. So why don't you start us off? Just like tell us what is even the field? Is network theory the right term for it? Or I've heard people refer to network science or other things. Like, what is it? What are some of the basic concepts and the approach? And what kinds of things can it tell us that other approaches to studying social phenomena might not?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. At the heart of it all is that humans are social animals, so we depend on each other for all kinds of things, and we've evolved to a point where we really can't function without the other people around us, and we organize ourselves, and that the organizations take certain patterns, and human networks are all of the patterns that describe those organizations. So who are my friends? Who are my acquaintances? Who are the people I work with at work? And it also extends to which companies do business with which other companies? What do supply chains look like? Which countries are trading with other countries? Which countries are in conflict with other countries? So it scales up and down, and it determines a lot of behaviors. And so that's why, as an economist, I'm interested in it. And I think, it has fundamental implications for all of our lives.
So what are some of the kinds of things you look at with networks? So you start out by like just looking at what, say, a firm is doing business with, who someone says are their friends, and, you can draw sort of a picture and connect the dots. But now once you've connected those dots, what kinds of things do you look for, or how can you build on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's sort of two starting points. One is that the potential ways in which we could organize ourselves is enormous. So if you think about all the possible friends you could have in the world, there's a huge number of them, and yet we have a small number. And the actual patterns that describe those interactions turn out to be important. So who is it that I end up interacting with, and how well are they connected to the network? So the kinds of things that we look at in a network to understand people's position and outcomes would be, you know, how central is their position, and where central can be defined in different ways, but how well connected are they in the network? When we look at the network as a whole, how much inequality is there in terms of people's connections? Are some people very isolated and other people very central? How divided is a network? So we look across groups. If we look across ethnicities or, you know, castes and in some societies, or by religion and so forth, do we see different network patterns across different groups? And do those patterns affect what kinds of information people have and how quickly they get that information and what they believe and what opportunities they have? So there's a lot that we can say about what those networks look like and what kinds of patterns we see. And then what we try and do is use those patterns to see whether or not those predict how people are behaving and what kinds of outcomes we see. And that sort of informs policy. So if we really want to attack inequality or polarization or contagion, these things, fundamentally networks are at the heart of them. And we really need to understand those structures in order to really optimally design those policies.
Okay, well, why don't we talk maybe specifically about one of those, inequality. So, you know, if I have, what do you look for in a network, and, you know, what does it tell you beyond like just looking at someone's, you know, standard demographic characteristics, like their level of education and their, you know, savings or income, wealth, things like that? What more do you get from the network analysis, and what conclusions can you draw from that?
Sure. So I think, you know, if you take the classic view of inequality, and a lot of the studies that people have looked at have sort of concentrated on things like financial capital and human capital. So, you know, how much wealth does a family have, and then how well educated are people? So if I'm well educated and I'm wealthy, then I should be succeeding. And if I'm poor and don't have much education, then I'm going to be in a worse situation. And I think what networks add to that picture is often what people call social capital. And I think that it's sort of an important piece of the puzzle, because, you know, if we take somebody who's in a disadvantaged situation, so a person who is in a community that's not well employed, that doesn't have the skills that are going to earn a good income, and we just give that one individual an education, that helps the person, but it doesn't necessarily enable them to get employment if none of the people around them and the people that they're usually in contact with are employed. And so once we start looking at the networks of contacts and how people get jobs and how people get job interviews and so forth, one realizes that you know, education is one piece of a puzzle, but how well connected somebody is into the workforce is another important piece. And so if you want to design a policy that gets people employed from disadvantaged backgrounds, it's not only just giving them loans to get an education, but then also making sure that they're able to take advantage of that education once they have it. And so those are the kinds of insights that one gets from looking at this, which are different from just taking a purely economic perspective.
So how do you collect data, say, in that case about different people, just to identify people who maybe are not just less well off or less educated, but also lack network access to opportunities? How do you sort of document that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that people have looked at these things, and some of them look at, you can collect data directly, say, in high schools, or what friendships exist within a high school, and you'll find fairly strong segregation patterns within high schools, typically both across ethnicity and income levels throughout the United States. I haven't looked at high schools outside of the United States, but when you look in them inside the United States, you see pretty strong patterns of that form. And if you look at, you can look at other kinds of data sets where you're, in some studies we've done in India, we've gone in and surveyed people and directly measured the connections of who they're sharing food and money with and resources and medical help, things like that. And you can begin to look at how that crossed caste lines and how that crossed income lines and education lines within villages. You can look across gender lines. So you can begin to see what those segregation patterns look like, often from surveys. Now, with modern data, we can also look, via various social media platforms. They provide data of people's friendships and connections. So there's a lot of different ways in which you can gather that data. You can also, there's government data available in different places. So, the location where somebody lives in, you can say something about their communities. So there's different ways in which we can get at these connections and then begin to measure what access do people have to other individuals who are employed and how does that matter? So there's lots of techniques that we can use and increasingly larger data sets available to study this.
So what would be an example of something where, a policy of people that could be pursued if you recognize that maybe just, handing someone money or, putting them in a better school might not be enough? How could you intervene on, because social networks, we can talk more about how do you even define these links? Like if I have a bunch of people that I follow on Instagram, I'm not sure that's going to get me a job, right? So that's one kind of link, or, other kinds of link could be like, who are my friends and relatives? And it's pretty hard for me just like get more friends and relatives very easily. So how do we decide what counts as a link and how do we help people create links that'll be beneficial to them?
Yeah, it's not an easy process. So social engineering and rewiring networks is not easy by any means. And I think one thing that comes out of it are what I like to call policy cocktails. And that means that we don't use policies in isolation, but we think of them as combined. And the kinds of insights we get about that are, if we want to help in education, we need to work on educating the children. We also need to work on educating the parents of those children as to how the education matters and how to best educate their children, both in school and out of school in terms of, non-cognitive skills. And then we also need to put that together with the kinds of access that people need to eventually get out of a poverty trap, meaning that they eventually have to have opportunities to get employment. And, taking a network perspective then also gives you an idea that the more people in a community that you begin to get employed, the more opportunities can flow into that community, because, you really need to know somebody in a company to get an interview. You need to have connections in order to get heard and to have those opportunities to advance. And the more that those are built, the more leverage you have. And so I think it goes together with thinking that these policies need to be combined so that we have all the ingredients that are necessary. And these can leverage the network so that once a community starts getting some people involved, then they can get more involved. And, things like mentorship programs try and bring people from a community back into that community to help others learn how to do what they needed to do to get to, to be successful. And then also to get opportunities through those people and to get referrals from those people so that they can, follow the same kinds of paths. And the more that happens, then it snowballs and there's sort of a social multiplier effect, if you would. And so the idea here is both combining the policies and taking advantage of the network features of those policies.
Okay, so that makes sense. Are there any instances where this has been done successfully?
Well, I mean, I guess the most striking kinds of instances are ones that are fairly dramatic, but not ones we would want to use on a large scale. So I think probably the most famous, you know, the moving to opportunity study that was done in the 1990s as a part of an act of Congress was an experiment where they gave people money to move to change neighborhoods. And they took people from relatively poor neighborhoods and moved them into wealthier neighborhoods. And there you can see the effects on the children that moved into those wealthier neighborhoods. Years later, they end up having much better outcomes than the children who were not moved under the same program. And so, you know, that gives you some idea of the magnitude of this, but that's not a program where you're putting all these things together. And I think, they're increasingly now when people are thinking about policies, they are beginning to think along the lines of combining these. But often you'll see, okay, we need a policy to redistribute income, or we need universal basic income, or you'll hear discussions about early childhood education and so forth. But I think, you know, we need to take a holistic view of this, and you don't see as many holistic policies designed in that way.
Doesn't it though, a lot of the policy work, especially when economists have been involved, we've sort of almost pushed it in the other direction because we've been advocating for, you know, randomized controlled trials and, you know, carefully designed things that sort of, you know, it's easiest to do when you're looking at one thing at a time. Whereas if you put together a whole package of stuff, even if you then, you know, randomly apply that package to people, you may not know which parts of it actually work or not. So doesn't that make it harder to have kind of confidence as a social scientist that, like, in terms of, I mean, you still see if something works as a package, but then you end up not knowing what parts of the package are really important. How do you disentangle that?
Yeah, it's actually a very timely question. I've just been working on a research project with a big team from both Stanford and MIT, including Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo and Arun Chandrasekhar and then a host of others. What we've been doing is trying to understand how to get, this was done in Haryana in India. We're trying to get people to immunize. So we're trying to improve programs that encourage parents to vaccinate their children. And in that situation, there's a bunch of different ways in which you could go about doing this. So you can, actually pay people for vaccinating their kids. You can have various other interventions where you have well-known people from the area endorse it. You can send reminders. So there's, four or five different policy options. And then there's different ways in which you can do those. And so when you put it all together in the study we're doing, there's something like, 75 different policies that you could consider. And doing a randomized controlled trial is quite complicated on that. But what you can do with sort of modern statistical techniques is begin to, look at combinations of these things. And from the way that the combinations work, you can figure out which aspects of it are important. And from that, sort of back out what the value added of each different component is, and then actually try and design an optimal policy and estimate how good it is from the data. So it's possible to do randomized controlled trials with lots of different policy arms at the same time, and you learn that, actually from that study we see that if we had tried one at a time, none of them would have looked like they worked, but when you put them together, they actually work fairly well. So having somebody remind somebody or having somebody prominent in the village come in and talk to them, neither of those would have done anything, nor would just paying them on their own. But when you put all three of those in combination in certain ways, then you actually get, like a 50%, or I guess it was 45% increase in the participation. Wow. Within those villages. So you get a substantial bump from combinations of these things. And that's something we can do now, right? You can, with modern the scales at which we can do interventions now and track them and analyze them allows us to look at policy cocktails and analyze them fairly clearly.
You must need a pretty large scale to roll that out though, right? You know, pretty large sample size.
Yeah. So this had a huge investment from the local government and, you know, involved tens of thousands of subjects and you know, several years of interventions and observations. So it's not easy to do these kinds of things, but the importance of the kinds of things we're talking about, you know, getting a society immunized or getting a society educated, these are such deep and important questions that the amount of money that's involved in doing these kinds of studies is really peanuts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's true. From, you know, it seems as an academic ordinary person, it may seem like a lot of money, but when you think about the social benefits or, you know, what governments are spending on policies, which may or may not be effective all the time, then it maybe doesn't look so bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's great. That sounds like a really, you know, important work in obviously directly in the development context, but presumably there may be some learning from that can be carried over to thinking about influencing pro-social behaviors of various kinds in other settings. Another thing you've worked on is kind of looking at, you know, the question of, well, I think your chapter title is The Wisdom or Folly of Crowds, right? We talk about things like crowdsourcing, but also there's, you know, the classic book, The Madness of Crowds. People worry about groupthink, you know, is it better or worse when you get people together? So shifting gears a little bit. So what can studying networks tell us about this?
Yeah, I guess there's sort of two different insights I think that are fairly central that come out of network analysis to understanding belief formation. One is that we often underestimate how segregated our networks are and the extent to which we're hearing information that comes to us through multiple people, but might be traced back to the same source, right? So, you know, if three of my friends are all reading the same news media, and then they independently tell me something, it's natural for me, once I've heard something three times, to believe it more than if I've just heard it once. Even if I'm really rational and thinking carefully about it, I don't necessarily say, oh, it really could be that all three of these people read the same article and they're just repeating it to me. And the more similar my network is, the more likely that the people around me are all getting their information from the same sources. And as humans, we're just sort of natural counters. And the more we hear something and the more we hear one thing versus another, we believe that first thing versus another thing. And that, you know, I guess it's become sort of popularized under the terminology echo chambers in the media and so forth. But I think it's when we get down to the networks, we can actually see exactly how this works and where it's going to happen and what kinds of information it's going to happen with. And there are subtleties in this structure. And, you know, some ideas can spread very widely and other ones can can be distorted and trapped. And I think, you know, understanding the network structure helps us understand that. And there's other biases that we have. You know, we don't account for the fact that most of the people we're talking to are not random samples from the population in terms of how prominent they are, but they're the most prominent people. So if you know, you're following somebody on Twitter, usually the people you're following on Twitter are the people with the most followers. And most of the stuff that comes through your feed is going to be the people who are broadcasting to the most people. And the people who are broadcasting to the most people aren't necessarily, you know, random samples from the society. And that comes with biases. And so I think, you know, all of these biases reflect the structure of the network, but are ones that we often overlook when we form our opinions.
So how do you study this? Like, what's the balance between, you know, purely theoretical analysis of, you know, just draw the graph and figure out in principle how things could work versus gathering data and looking at specific contexts?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of three levels at which this is studied. And the first one is, you know, we're very good now at doing the theory side of things and working out what would happen if a society had a certain kind of graph structure to it and people, you know, talked to each other at certain rates and then believed things that their friends told them with a certain probability. That's something that we have pretty tractable models of, and we can see how that works. The second level of that is then often just taking it into a laboratory. So, you know, we can sit people down at computer terminals and put them together and then give them information about, you know, a fictional problem that they have to solve, something that they, you know, that they're trying to discover and understand, and then see how they behave and whether the kinds of theories that we have actually match up with that. And then the third level is doing this in the wild. And that is the hardest level because it's often the one that we have the least control over. So, you know, if we want to see how people are forming their beliefs about, you know, an upcoming election or a vaccine program or things like that, there it's harder. You know, we don't have as much control over what the network is. They're hearing things from, you know, they might be on Facebook and hearing something. They might be on Twitter getting something else. They might be getting something from cable news. They might be getting something from their friends. So there's all, you know, directly from their friends and conversations that we don't observe. And so putting all of those influences together, that's the hardest part. And so often you'll see studies done on some particular, you know, medium and then trying to see, you know, what happens as a function of the structure that we can observe there and the information flows we can observe there. And, you know, you have to be pretty clever then about, you know, tracing who knew what when and how that affected their behavior.
So does this mean that I shouldn't listen to my friends, or, you know, how do I guess as an individual, what can I do to ameliorate this? And then also as a society, you know, to the extent that like this might contribute to political polarization, is there, you know, we can analyze it and describe it and say it probably exists. Is there anything we can do about it?
Yeah, I guess, you know, on one level, you know, so let's take one particular aspect, the fact that I'm going to tend to associate with other people who are very similar to myself. So that's known as homophily. If I'm talking to somebody, they're much more likely to be an economist than some other profession. They're more likely to have a similar age to me. They're more likely to have a similar education background and so forth. So there's a bunch of things that are going to be true about my friends that correlate their experiences, past experiences and outlooks with me. Okay. So on the one hand, that can be limiting because then we have this, you know, what we just talked about in terms of they don't have as much diverse access to information. On the other hand, that can actually be quite useful because those are the people that I can actually learn the most from in terms of having common experiences and facing the same challenges going forward. So, for instance, if we're trying to get a teenager from a disadvantaged background into university that's fairly demanding, what they have to go through and what their experience is going to be like, and what kinds of both academic and social and mental challenges they're going to face are something that are probably best expressed by somebody who has come from the same background and gone through the same kinds of experiences. And so on the one hand, talking to people who are very similar to yourself gives you much higher quality information and better information, but it gives you less diverse information, right? So there's this trade-off between the diversity of the information and sort of how useful that information is to you and how much you can make of somebody else's experience. And I think the thing that we can all do as people is understand what that trade-off is and understand when is it that we really need diversity in our information and when is it that we should be reaching out beyond our networks. And as a society, we can also try to make it easier for people to reach out beyond their networks when they need that more diverse information that they don't have. And, you know, try to help through mentorship programs or through internship programs or, you know, put people into situations where they can learn more if their networks aren't giving them information, but without destroying the network structure that provides them that basic support and useful high quality information that they also need.
Right. No, that sounds like a great set of things to introduce, but a tricky balance. Yeah. Whether you want that person who you kind of can trust and is from your community in some sense, and can, you know, understand your own situation when they're talking to you versus someone who's just, too much from your own community and therefore doesn't have the perspective of the broader world, the broader network.
Exactly.
So let's talk now a little bit about kind of the broader context of work on networks. I think when you started working on networks in the 1990s, at that point, my sense is that, and you can correct me on this, is, you know, they're pretty popular among sociologists, and there are a few physicists working on it, you know, from a very different perspective, but it was almost completely absent from economics as, you know, a concept or even things we thought about at that point. So how did you decide to start working on it, and how did other people react when you told them you were working on networks?
So it was serendipity. I was having a lunch conversation with Asher Walensky, and at the time I was working pretty heavily in economic theory and using game theoretic models to analyze institutions and people's interactions through those. And Asher and I were talking at lunch about, you know, what is it that makes somebody powerful? What, you know, how could we measure whether somebody has a better position and is better able in some organization or something to have influence and to change outcomes and so forth. And, you know, we started looking through the sociology literature and realizing that the kinds of questions that we naturally posed as economists of people would want to put themselves in these particular situations, but now everybody would like to be in those more powerful situations. And if everybody is trying to form relationships at the same time with this in mind, what's going to happen? And so that was sort of the entry point that I had into studying networks. And over time, it's grown as economists and other social scientists have become increasingly aware of sort of the importance of social networks in understanding various human behaviors. So it's changed quite a bit over the years, but that was sort of my introduction into it. And I just became fascinated with it. And you're right, there was a lot of study in sociology, starting more than a century ago, and a pretty rich literature of various studies of how people arrange themselves and some of the implications of that. And I think the healthy thing is that each one of these different disciplines brings in a different perspective. So, you know, physicists had been studying statistical mechanics of particles and interaction systems and had a mathematics associated with that. There's random graph theory from math. There's computer scientists who've been thinking about designing platforms and also just in general, network systems and economists bring us an understanding of how people make choices and how that kind of interaction structure impacts behaviors. And so you can put all these different pieces together and you get a pretty rich mosaic of both the structures of organizations and the ways in which they determine outcomes.
Do you feel like you have a lot of productive conversations with people coming from these different disciplinary backgrounds?
Yes, most definitely. And I think, there's actually increasing research on this now that finding that research that happens across boundaries of fields tends to often involve more frequent synergies than and advances than you would find, directly within a field. And I think, talking to other people and using, combining the tools that allow us to study a large interacting system, but then still have incentives involved and understand behaviors and, mix this with data, this involves a pretty wide perspective and bringing tools from different disciplines and thinking about it from different angles is pretty vital.
Yeah, and you mentioned at the start, I was going to ask you, how is it that economists approach this a little bit differently? But I think you mentioned one key thing is that, we tend to, view people as strategic, intentional actors. And so it's not like just the network kind of drops down on our heads and we just live in it, but we also choose, who to make friends with, who to contact, who to interact with, and kind of shape the network ourselves.
Yes, definitely. And I think that perspective is important because it's clear that when we observe the patterns that are out there that they're quite different than would be just purely influenced by the combination of environment and chance, that there's discretion that goes on as well. And understanding that discretion, can be very important. And I think it matters to different extents at different levels. If you look at how people organize themselves within a small classroom at a fairly young age, discounting gender, the graphs look fairly random. But as people get older, they organize themselves in increasingly rich patterns. And also when you look at, things like the way that companies choose who they're trading with or countries choose who they're allied with, these are certainly networks that have an enormous amount of discretion in them. And, if we want to understand financial contagions, we really have to understand the incentives of banks to lend to each other and the incentives of various parties to be borrowing from those banks and how those are going to cross borders and how that adjusts to different regulations. Those are questions that there's no way you could answer them without, having an economic perspective in it.
Right. I mean, that's, kind of finance is more our home territory, but like where do the networks play into looking at issues about like financial instability?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there was a real wake-up call in 2008. I mean, the financial crisis that hit really changed the perspective. And at that time, since then, I've talked to people at this, not only the Fed, but the central banks in Europe, and UK, Mexico, around the world. And I think that they're increasingly aware of the fact that if you want to understand systemic risk, if you want to understand the risky position that some particular financial enterprise is in, you can't just look at their balance sheet. You have to be looking at the balance sheet of their counterparties and who they're doing business with. And then it instantly sort of expands outwards. And so they're gathering more and more information about what the network looks like. And stress testing now is done. It's not just that a particular bank might be under stress, but if you put a bunch of its partners under stress at the same time, then the chances that you're going to have a catastrophic event are much, much higher. And, I think we dodged a bullet in 2008 and 2009 in some ways. I mean, it was a prolonged recession, but the acts of the Federal Reserve and Treasury were to move in with enough capital to make a difference fast enough that we didn't have a widespread contagion. But it could have been much worse. And I think we've learned from that. And now we have a much better understanding of the importance of the network. And we're slowly getting better data, but there's a long way to go.
Right. So it sounds like they're moving past the perspective of maybe that you get from an intro stats or econometrics class where you kind of treat each firm or as a separate observation or, separate item you can analyze by itself, and recognizing that, well, actually they're all interlinked in a systemic way, which makes them not kind of fit into that format as cleanly as we might like.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's become, now there's more research that shows that it's not only that they're interconnected, but they tend to have very correlated portfolios. So when you begin to put together the fact that they tend to be invested in the same assets. So for instance, in 2008, many of the largest banks were all invested in subprime mortgages and various mortgage backed securities and other kinds of derivatives associated with those. And you put that together with then a shock to that market. And it's not only that any particular one of them is in distress, but then the interlinkages between them and the fact that they're all under stress at the same time is, puts you in a dangerous situation. And a stressor like COVID is also a major stressor on the financial system. And, we haven't quite seen the impact of that yet. But there's going to be a number of defaults on loans from companies that are going to go bankrupt because of the pandemic. And that, will in turn lead to portfolio problems for certain banks, and the extent to which those banks are interlinked with each other, can be quite a problem if it's not understood beforehand.
Right. So it's another thing to kind of keep an eye on as a regulator and be aware of. So it's not just each firm, not each firm on its own or each bank on its own footing, but recognizing that they're all one can drag down a lot of others.
Yes. Yeah. Most definitely.
So speaking of the pandemic, obviously, your book actually assigned it for a class, and the students definitely clued into getting into the chapter about contagion. That's obviously very, very directly relevant for them thinking about the lives that we're living now and the risks that everyone's trying to take. Have you done any work specifically since the pandemic kind of or policy advising or anything, just kind of using network theory to apply to how we respond to the pandemic, or are there any things where maybe we've made mistakes that, a better understanding of the functioning of networks might have helped us avoid them, at least in retrospect?
Yeah. I mean, let me mention a couple of things, and I'll be a little careful because we have one article that's just forthcoming, but it's embargoed, so I won't talk about that specifically, but I can talk generally about this. And I think, one part of it, so there's sort of, I think, two major lessons that we have that are important in understanding the contagion and how things are working in the pandemic. And one is that, the kinds of basic things that we talk about in terms of reproduction numbers and so forth don't necessarily account for the full heterogeneity in populations. And so the kinds of models that network scientists use to understand pandemics and predict the evolution of a disease take into account the fact that there's a lot of heterogeneity in populations, and some parts of the population are much more susceptible and can be hotspots. And so it could be that an overall society on average doesn't have such a high propensity to infect each other and to propagate a disease, but there could be certain pockets where that is much higher than others. And the more asymmetric the society is in terms of those numbers, the more a disease can actually thrive. So it's not just the average, but this sort of asymmetries in the structure of interactions can make a big difference as well. And I think that's important when we put it together. And so that means that, you know, there's certain areas where there's going to be higher contact rates, higher susceptibility, less vaccination and so forth. And that can lead those places to basically maintain and foster a disease that could be almost completely eradicated in another place. And then over time, that means it's going to come back, right? If this world is interconnected, which our world is increasingly interconnected, then that means that you're inevitably going to have that come back. And over time, I think there's only, one disease in human history that we've managed to fully eradicate. And you know, it's because it's very difficult to make sure that you're stamping things out all over. And I think that that couples together with an economic perspective of what we know as externalities, which is that, you know, one person's problem becomes another person's problem. And so in particular, when we're looking across governments, the fact that governments aren't necessarily coordinating, you know, means that for instance, in vaccinating now, we're all sort of worried about vaccinating our own populations. But the more that we're worried about vaccinating our own populations, the less that is being paid attention to what's happening in other places where there's not as strong a vaccination rate, which then allows the disease to thrive more in certain environments. And that asymmetry can be worse than if we were, you know, had a world consortium to very carefully roll the vaccine out on a world scale rather than doing it each country on their own.
Right. So even if we were successful in vaccinating, you know, everyone in the U.S., then still, you know, most likely poorer countries if we don't share a vaccine with them or help them get access to vaccines, then they can kind of serve as a reservoir and continue to, be affected economically, which also, you know, affects the rest of the world, but also, develop new strains and just be that pool from which it could come roaring back to the rest of the world at any point.
Exactly. And I think that you sort of hit it on you know, both of those levels. One is that, you know, now our economies are increasingly interacting. And so, you know, if the supply chain is disrupted for critical, you know, we just saw what happened just with, you know, a week of loss in the Suez Canal. You know, the global supply chains are important now. And so you start cutting that in from certain countries, if their economies are doing poorly, that's going to hurt others. And then the second part of the longer that we have large populations that are not vaccinated, the more we will have new variants and changes in the structure of this. And instead, trying to get this all under control at once would lead to a lowering chance that you're going to have new variants developing and eventually, you know, needing new vaccines to deal with those new variants. And, you know, the longer the virus is out in the wild and the longer it's multiplying and the longer it's exposed to partially vaccinated populations, you know, the worse it becomes. And so figuring out a way to get everybody vaccinated most efficiently rather than, you know, doing it haphazardly would be to the world's advantage in the long run. And yet, you know, it's very difficult to find in countries willing to cooperate with each other on this.
Right. It's always, it's a natural tendency to say, well, you know, sure, I should take care of other people, but I got to take care of my own people first and maybe not recognize the extent to which taking care of other people sometimes is necessary to take care of your own people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, right now it's a lot of sharing. You know, there is sharing, but it's often, well, we've got extra, or, you know, we're in a situation where now we're in a good shape. Now we can share this with you, or we'll share something that we found we don't like and doesn't work. Or,
yeah.
You know, it's not a farsighted and foresighted interaction.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't exactly engender trust if they say, well, we've got this vaccine we like best and you guys can have our other one. That's, Yeah, especially you know, the U.S. and other developed countries do not have the best record of being thoughtful about medical issues in other countries, respecting, giving them reasons to trust us can be a problem. Or people in our own country, unfortunately, as well. So on a different topic, so I'm managing a master's program at the University of San Francisco, where we are trying to train students to understand and work in the digital economy. And you're also based here in Silicon Valley. I'm accidentally like referring to your book as The Social Network, and I have to correct myself when I actually see the title. So in that context, you know, what are some of the insights that we talk about social networks all the time, and there's so much data that comes out of online interactions that certainly much easier to gather than just the old way of maybe interviewing people in a survey and saying, who are your friends? But what are some of the insights that your book or this area of research can offer to people in the tech sector who are creating and shaping these online networks that we're all part of, or to policymakers who are trying to figure out is there some kind of regulation necessary, and how can they intervene in a positive way?
Right. I think there's several things. So one is that often the algorithms that are there are ones that try quite actively and deliberately to put people together who look similar to each other, right? And find people who have similar interests, put them together, find the things that look like what I've clicked on before. If news stories look like that, show that one, the next one to me that looks very similar to the previous one. And, that sort of exacerbates the kind of homophily and divisions within networks that we see, where we build increasingly homogeneous interactions. And I think that, that's sort of just a natural evolution of it, but I think it's humans have that kind of tendency, but it gets amplified by the algorithm interacting with the human and that feedback to say, okay, look, you liked this, we're going to give you more of what you liked. And, connecting, like on LinkedIn, somebody, the kinds of names it's going to suggest are people that I have lots of other connections to already. So I already have lots of indirect connections to these. It's not suggesting people that I have very few connections to. And naturally, I'm more skeptical of people that I have very few connections
to. When I do get those kind of random LinkedIn invitations from someone who has no connections to me, or maybe, one or two connections to people who maybe I don't know very well, then yeah, I'm usually pretty skeptical of that. So, I mean, are they wrong to sort of curate or filter the networks in this way?
Yeah, no. So I think that the hard part is there's sort of, how do we get around this? And I think there's two aspects to it. One is that, you're right, they're not necessarily wrong, because if they're just giving me a product I enjoy and that I use a lot, I'm probably going to, use it more when they give me things I click yes on and that I resonate with me and so forth. And I think that that's also exacerbated by competition. So if they don't do it, and if they start saying, look, we're going to try and help you a little bit by diversifying your network and giving you some connections to people that you normally wouldn't have connected with, but we think would offer you really valuable information, I might say, why are they connecting me to all these people I don't know? And this seems kind of strange. And even though it might be beneficial for me in the short run, it might, you might lose users that way. And showing people more balanced news feeds, might get them to be less interested in the news feed than if you're showing them stuff that really gets them emotionally active. And so... I think that competition in this particular industry means that now you're trying to keep people on your platform, you're trying to keep them engaged in your platform, and so that pushes things more and more in that direction. How do you deal with this? That's a tough question, and I think part of it is just making sure that users themselves understand the biases in their networks and how undiversified their news feeds can be, and how that gets exacerbated not only by the beginning homophily, but then the interactions on, you know, at different levels of what gets filtered through them by their friends, and then what they actually see because of the algorithm, and then also what they click on. And, you know, once you've taken this like four levels, you get a pretty selected set of stuff. And I think the more people understand that, the more they could begin to appreciate, you know, the more diverse information stories and connections to people outside their realms. But, you know, designing an algorithm that does that in a way that then people appreciate and understand isn't easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause right. Like you said, if I just get random introductions to people, I can't imagine that I'd want to talk to, or, you know, I get things in my newsfeed from the, you know, the network that gets outraged over the things I think are great and thinks things are great that I'm inclined to get outraged over, then it doesn't really, draw me in. So is there any, like, is there any, useful thing that policymakers are thinking about, or that you or anyone else is advocating, you know, for how to try to at least mitigate this problem?
No, I mean, I can give you what I think works in off platforms, and then we can talk about how you might begin to integrate this into platforms. And, you know, one thing we found, so we looked at high schools and looked at ethnic divisions and friendships within high schools. And we used what's known as the AdHealth data set. And so, you know, you have a bunch of different high schools and you can look at what the friendship patterns look like inside those. And you say, okay, look, you know, it looks like the whites form friendships with whites, blacks form friendship with blacks. You don't see much integration across them. But what you also notice is, the larger the high school and the bigger the critical masses of different groups, the more they segregate. And the high schools and the groups that tend to be well integrated into their surroundings tend to be small ones. So the smaller you make the school, the more people are sort of forced to be in contact with each other, and the more you get those, you know, cross-cutting friendships and relationships. And so if you're, you know, if you're a large school, and now universities like Stanford and other schools are reorganizing the way they do their dorms and so forth, one way to deal with this is, instead of just putting people in a giant free-for-all where, you know, they go to a large cafeteria with all of the dorms together, build small communities within that and have people in more constant contact with other people within those communities. And once the communities become small enough, there's sort of a, you know, it's really a nonlinear effect. Then suddenly you get a lot more interaction and a lot more interaction across groups. And so one question is, you know, so how do you sort of shrink that world, but not shrink it to just a group that's all like me, but shrink it to a world where I'm suddenly interacting with people who aren't like me, but on a, you know, a few people in a more frequent basis. And that seems to work on high school levels, and it seems to work on a college level, a university level. And then the question is, how do we scale that up to social media and, you know, larger scales where we can begin to put people into discussion groups that are diverse, and where you go and you meet the same people and you talk over time and you learn more about them and you learn more about their perspectives. But, you know, if we just sort of show you one or two weird connections, you're not going to say, oh, wow, that's somebody I want to connect to. That looks like it's out of the blue. But if we could get people to somehow be in small communities and repeatedly interact with each other on a small scale, but a diverse scale, that would be one way to help expose people and to actually get those cross-cutting relationships formed.
Right. Yeah. I guess the challenge there is, you know, in education, we have a lot more control over people, right? They can't really opt out of the system, and, you know, we can assign them to dorms, or we can assign them to high school classrooms, or even, you know, different high schools. When you think about, like, especially people like just clicking through on an online platform, then it's really easy for them to opt out or get turned off very rapidly. So that's quite a challenging case to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know what the solution is so far, but I think that, you know, there's lessons that we've learned through seeing how people interact that we can begin to, you know, maybe it's even, it could be in gaming or something else where you start to sort of build groups together and allow people to interact within some bubble where they can be nudged in directions that allow them to enrich their networks. I think, you know, at the same time, I think there's dangers, you know, it's hard because the algorithms have to make choices, and we don't want to make choices to censor people or to push people and force people into certain patterns. But at the same time, we want to enable them to be able to, you know, check the veracity of the information they're getting, to get more access to diverse sources, to connect outside of their usual groups, and offering those opportunities without forcing it on them is not easy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's one of our big questions, but I guess that, you know, that's, as you say, you know, the key thing is to start to understand it, and we can start to understand it in some settings like schools, which are important in their own right. Cause you know, that's where we build the foundations of a lot of the rest of our lives. Anyway, but also then, yeah, that can give insights at least into what we should be hoping to drive towards in other arenas. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, but I really appreciate it. It's been really fascinating talking with you about this. So what else, just as a last thing, you've mentioned a couple of things. What else are you working on now? Where are you going with this next?
Yeah, studies I'm most excited about now that I think is going to take a while for it to come to fruition because of the pandemic is there's a group of researchers out of the Santa Fe Institute where we've designed a set of questions that people are taking to different societies around the world. And we're asking social network questions like, who are your friends? Who do you share food with? Who do you borrow from? And then we're also collecting a lot of basic information about people's consumption and wealth, and going, you know, we'll have about 30 different societies analyzed around the world, and you know, small scale societies and hunter gatherer societies, agricultural societies, and from those, and looking at differences both in the networks and some of the institutions, the hope is that we can better understand what leads to things like inequality, what affects growth of these societies. So, you know, it's a pretty ambitious project, but by using exactly the same measurements across these different settings and having teams go in and carefully implement pretty much exactly the same study, but in these different environments, we can start comparing across environments and seeing things at a level that we don't have, we've never had data like that before. So I'm pretty excited about this.
Yeah, that is, really sort of a new way to approach kind of a cross-cultural study, you know, very different from, obviously anyone who does cross-cultural research, you know, anthropologists doing participant observation or whoever, you know, sociologists doing surveys or whatever, probably, you know, tries to make things comparable, but often the resources are such that you end up, you know, referencing previous research, but you kind of go and do your own thing in the one country that you are working on. And so getting a real global perspective, comparative perspective sounds like a great direction to go in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks again. This has been really exciting to learn from you today. I think the listeners will really appreciate it. Professor Jackson's book is called The Human Network. And I think I saw you also have some online courses that people can take as well.
Yes. I have an online course called Social and Economic Networks through Coursera, which will take people into, you know, some of the details of how we map out networks and how we measure learning and model it and so forth. So there's an online course on that. And then Also involved in co-teaching a couple of game theory courses on Coursera as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and especially, I mean, that for this kind of work, you know, having the book or having someone draw some networks out on a board really makes a huge difference. Like, even if you're not going to dig into all the math of the details of how things work out, a lot of them have pretty strong intuition once you even just like see a few different pictures. But having that visual element is particularly important.
Yeah, most definitely.
To get into it. All right. Well, thanks so much, and hope you'll write another book someday, and we can talk again.
That'd be great. Thank you, Peter.